So this is just to kind of give you a little bit of a glimpse of some of my other colleagues internationally that go, that do this as well. So we've got folks in, you know, the UK, in Italy.
Tucson, Arizona.
And so people all over the country that do this very thing. And so the Building Blocks of Hope, the book itself actually was a venture authored by all of us. So we all contributed to creating it. Anyway, all right. So, you know, looking at a number of these questions, so that's what we'll talk about. And, you know, I know Dr. Kay talked a lot about this. And I would encourage you to, you know, to pick up one of your, pick up one of the books. They're also available online in a PDF document, so if you're an electronic person and you want it on a tablet, you could do that as well. And, you know, I think part of owning the characteristics of your health is really getting a better understanding of what type of illness do you have. And so really getting to understand not only the globalness of the MDS, but what are you, where are you? You know, this Sharon tells us that she has 5Q minus, right? So she knows that. And so some of the things that we've heard today, we know that that, as one of the subtypes in MDS, can be treated with lenalidomide and acts a little bit differently than some of the other MDS subtypes. So, you know, you should, it would be probably helpful for you if you know, like, what disease you have and when you were diagnosed, if you can get the IPSS score. And there's actually, if you go to the MDS Foundation website, you can actually put all of your information in from your pathology report and come up with your score. Now, that score is done initially. That's when it's valid. So you don't rescore yourself as you go on. You get scored at the very beginning of your diagnosis.
So the scoring happens at the beginning. Your score doesn't change.
That's correct, because that's the starting point of where you're being diagnosed and how your treatment plan is going to be coordinated.
Okay, all through the course of the disease.
So
you're going to stay at that unless you change something, like have a bone marrow transplant, which could...
So when you get the diagnosis, it pretty much, it kind of stamps you with a label, right? So, for instance, if you have RAEB1, so you have a refractory anemia with excess blast type 1, that's what you were diagnosed with. And as treatment starts, say even with Vidaza, you're treated along the lines knowing that that was your diagnosis. Now, you may be on therapy with azacitidine for like 6 months and you don't no longer need transfusions and you're feeling fine, but you still carry the label of the initial diagnosis.
And does your label still include that score, that you're intermediate, then you stay intermediate?
It does, because what the IPSS score is, that it's the international scoring system. And so what it's designed to do, that's not a diagnosis. That's really to help the clinician and you to understand the expectations of what usually happens with that subtype.
Okay. But it isn't like staging in breast cancer where they say, oh, well, she started out at stage 2, but now she's at stage 4. You don't move like that. There isn't any equivalent in MDS.
So the answer to that is sort of. They will never give you, they'll never turn the clock backwards. So say you're an RAEB2, right? And you're getting transfusions, you stopped being transfusion dependent. So oftentimes the physician will document RAEB2 on treatment, no longer needing transfusions. But what we know about the more aggressive types of MDS is that the natural history of the disease is that about 20% of people can evolve to acute leukemia, okay, which is treated differently than myelodysplastic syndrome. Mm-hmm. And so if you progress and things get worse, then they'll change your label. Then they may say, you know, for people who are unfortunate enough to progress to leukemia, it'll say acute myeloid leukemia evolving from myelodysplastic syndrome. So that's when the label change can happen. But does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. But even if you're at the end, you're still going to be an intermediate.
So the risk is always done initially to mm-hmm. help categorize and predict potentially the tempo of your disease. And then we don't rescore people. Mm. It's so when Dr. Greenberg's study was done, that the IPSS scoring system, so in 1997, that's when that paper came out. So what that scoring system did was it looked backwards at 800 patients who had myelodysplastic syndrome. And at that point in time, they really didn't have a good understanding of what made some MDS is more aggressive than others. And so when they looked through the data, they wanted to see, is it male? Is it female? Do people have diabetes? I mean, what is it? What were the characteristics that they could glean and be able to come up with something that was relatively universally adaptable to people? Nowadays, so that paper's almost 20 years old, right? 1997 was when it was published. So the data, you know, came from before that. So maybe the data's 30 years old now for some of those patients. So some of the criticisms of that scoring system is that people were never treated. And so when we look at are you a low risk, an intermediate, 1-2, or a high risk, and then it gives that survival, right? But those were patients who never got treated. So they were followed, but there was no treatment. There was blood transfusions and maybe growth factors, red cell growth factor, white. But it was basically people who didn't have any treatment options. So nowadays, the IPSS-R, the revised one, what it begins to look at is it recognizes that the cytogenetic abnormalities help us more to understand how indolent or how aggressive the disease will be. And then it also factors in, you know, do you get blood transfusions or not? Because transfusions really impact overall health and survival. And I'm sure, like, that came out, like, 3 years ago. I'm sure it'll be revised again as well.
Okay.
As we understand things.
Now, there really is no treatment for the disease except for
azacitidine. Hypomethylators?
Transfusion.
Transplant. Transplants.
You mean cure? Is there a cure for the disease?
Well, is there a treatment for the disease that leads to a cure? There isn't.
So the treatments in MDS, actually, what they tend to do is to slow down the progression of the disease. So what you want to do is avoid the acceleration into leukemia. So people who have, used to call MDS pre-leukemia. And you say, why did they do that? Well, because in the world of pathology, the number of blasts in the bone marrow, okay, that's the diagnostic criteria. So 20 years ago, they said if you had 30% blasts or greater, you had acute leukemia. Now, they say 20%, because the difference between 20 and 30, the diseases behave relatively identically. You know, you have leukemia. And there's two different classifications. There's the first classification system, which was called the FAB, French, American, and British. And that's where the RAEB, that's where all that came from. Now we have the World Health Organization. And they're further defining. And I will tell you that there is an update coming within the next 12 months that will be out from the World Health Organization, further characterizing many diseases, including myelodysplastic syndrome. So there's even more information that will be added into the subtypes to further define them. A lot of them are molecular testing and cytogenetic. So is there a cure? So what we often hear is that the only hope for cure is a stem cell transplant, right? Mm-hmm. But stem cell transplant is not, it's not a benign therapy. It's a very aggressive therapy in that, number one, you get high doses of chemotherapy, and so you will have all the potential side effects of that, right? And then number two, in order for transplant to be successful, enough chemotherapy is given to eliminate, hopefully, all vestiges of the MDS clone, right? Clone simply means one cell looks like another, looks like another. So to get rid of the MDS and then allow the new stem cells to repopulate the bone marrow. But in order to do that, we have to give people immunosuppression drugs, which allow the person to accept the graft. So when you get the stem cells, it's called getting a graft. You're not really grafting a piece of skin. What you're getting is an infusion of these stem cells. It looks like a blood transfusion, honestly, but it's only these selected mother cells called the stem cells. That's it's fraught with difficulties because people can reject the graft. People can get these very unusual life-threatening infections, right, that are difficult to control. And, you know, people die from the process of transplant.
Yeah, you know, the person I talked to in WashU said that there's probably 40% in the older age group that won't make it.
40% that will make it?
Won't make it.
I agree. If you're over the age of 50, probably 4 out of 10 do not survive the first year after transplant. So, you know, it becomes, you know, risk and benefit, right? You know, am I going to be the 6 in 10? Am I going to be the 4 in 10? And clinicians then have developed a number of different categories that help us understand who will do better in transplant. Can they, you know, being up to the age of 75, centers across the country are doing transplants. So the center that I work at, actually, we're trying to specialize in doing these transplants for quote-unquote older patients. So we like people who are over 60, right? They present a unique set of challenges, but, you know, the fastest growing segment in our population are, A, people over the age of 80, but, you know, the people in 70s and 60s aren't far behind, right? That's just the demographics of our country. And
that's really where most of the disease is.
That's right. Yeah, many. We do. I will tell you, though, that we have people in their 30s. We've had a few people in their 20s, in 40s, 50s. You know, it's...
No, but the majority...
The majority can be, right. And then the other piece is, although transplant may pose a cure, you have to look at the other illnesses people may come to transplant with. Some people at 70 are robust and healthy, right? Other people have lots of other issues. They've had heart attacks. They have, you know, diabetes that they may already have peripheral neuropathy. They could have heart disease. They could have emphysema. I mean, the sky's the limit, right? And when do people mostly get those chronic diseases? When you're over 60, right? So you kind of have the double whammy of, you know, is this really possible? So, you know, I think it is possible, but when you look at who falls into that category, it's a small subset, you know. And, you know, the risks of going through the transplant they're high, you know. And people want to know, would I do this or, you know, shouldn't I do this, you know. Some people will say, I'll do anything for another day.
Everything that I've heard so mm-hmm. far about all these studies that are going on mm-hmm. are to extend.
Right.
There doesn't seem to be anything going on that's going to fix.
So you have to look at the cause of the disease is the stem cell abnormality. So when our blood gets created, let me go forward a little bit. Now, we talked about this a little bit, but let me just show you this. So when our blood cells are created, they're created inside the bone marrow, okay? And that's called a stem cell, a hematopoietic stem cell. That's just a fancy word saying a blood cell. And then it because of different influences in our bodies, both cytokines and hormones, it makes a decision. And it either becomes the family of the lymphoid cells or the family of the myeloid cells. But when you look at the disease of MDS, the error is all the way at the very beginning in the hematopoietic stem cell. So that very first cell is where the error is. So when you think about how do you cure this disease, we have no idea what really are the series of causative effects that someone has the propensity to then develop the disease. That's an unknown at this point in time. We don't know what causes it. If we knew what caused it, then we would certainly, you know, say, well, don't do X, Y, and Z, right? But we know that the error then occurs in the stem cell. So the natural, quote unquote, if you think about what's the cure is to give you a new healthy stem cell, right? And we do that by getting rid of yours and giving you somebody's that are new. That's the potential cure. And I have lots of patients who are cured and lots of patients who have MDS in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. We have a gentleman who's coming up on his one-year anniversary, a physician, 70 years old, very robust guy. You'd think he's 55. He looks great. He's done wonderful. No other illnesses. Meticulous health, good, you know, in shape, all the good things. Never a smoker, never a drinker. And so what's the cure? The cure is to fix the stem cell by either A, identifying the causes for disruption, or B, giving you a new one, you know? We have yet to have the science sufficient enough to say, okay, we know what the genetic abnormality is in the stem cell. How can we insert a gene to correct that abnormality? We're just not there yet. So for now, what we have to offer patients in 2015 is...
Well, is anybody working on that?
Sure, but it's decades away. Yeah.
Why?
That's how long it takes. It takes a long time.
Is it because of the funds? Mm-hmm. Or is it because...
They just haven't found it. They haven't identified the genes that do it. You know, what...
Well, how many genes are in that...
In the stem cell? All of you.
In your... No, how many genes are in your bone marrow?
So our DNA has all of our genetic material.
Okay. There's something wrong with the DNA in the...
In the stem cell.
No, there's something wrong with the DNA in the bone marrow that is creating the defective stem cell.
So some people ascribe to the theory that it's the, like the soil, like the bone marrow is the soil and the stem cells are the seeds. So some people say that there's an error and there's something wrong with the soil so you can't grow good crops, right? Or something's wrong with the seed. Or something's wrong with both of them. And people we have yet to really identify what's the bigger culprit. But when we look at therapies like 5-azacitidine or lenalidomide, with these treatments that people are potentially can get and benefit from, they do a couple things. Lenalidomide works in the soil. So it works in the bone marrow microenvironment amidst all the different complicated mechanisms in there to change the milieu of the soil. That's what lenalidomide does. That's a very simplistic description. 5-azacitidine works on the seed. So it works in the DNA because in DNA you have methyl groups, and that drug is a hypomethylator, or it blocks the methyl groups in the promoter region of the gene. So in genes, there's an engine that drives the replication of the DNA, and that's called the promoter region. So in the promoter region, they have too many methyl groups, and that helps block that and changes the look of the DNA. But it doesn't change the promoter group. It's a therapy to stop it. So you're absolutely right. How do you cure it? You know, all I can tell you is that they're working on both, you know, both situations. The soil and the seed are both being worked on. And therapies that are offered to patients look at treating one, if not both, of those areas to help improve the natural consequences of the disease. Make sense?
So, actually, the stem cell or the bone marrow transplant, mm-hmm. that would be kind of the last thing. I mean, that's your last resort, basically, as far as if your medication is not working. I mean, you can only, I mean, if the medication stops working, you either go in for a stem cell transplant or you just wait until you die. I mean,
or you try another, or you try another therapy.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's what I'm saying, though. But the, actually, the I would say the bone marrow transplant would kind of be the last thing that we would probably try. I mean, if everything's working well,
right?
Even some of the doctors kind of say, well, you don't want to wait till you get really sick
right.
to try to do a transplant, because then, I mean, you're already sicker, and then you've got to go through this chemotherapy, and so that's not good. But you don't want to go into it too soon either, because it's so drastic.
Right, right. Remember so. He showed the, Dr. K showed a grid, and it said, when do people get transplanted? People mm-hmm. with early stage disease should get transplanted later, but people with very aggressive disease should get transplanted sooner. Okay. And part of what we know is that people who have very aggressive disease are just a step away perhaps from having acute leukemia. One of the most important things about transplant is that people need to be in remission in order for transplant to be effective. And, you know, we have patients, you know, as providers, we discuss our patients at conferences and we get input from, you know, all of our colleagues. And, you know, if someone is not in remission, even if they have a donor, you know that the soil and the seed, it's not going to be cured by giving them a transplant. And they may have 6 or 9 months of remission, but you still have the vestiges of the malignancy, even with the new cells, and that person will probably relapse within 6 to 12 months.
What do you mean by remission?
Remission.
So I hear that talked about, but.
So when people are in remission, in the framework of. Does she need to come and sit on your lap? Why'd you sit on his lap? You good whining. When people talk about remission in myelodysplastic syndrome, it's different than if you're talking about it, say, in lymphoma or breast cancer, okay? Breast cancer, there's a, you know, there may be a malignant tumor. The tumor's removed. You know, maybe people get chemotherapy. They get re-imaged, and there's nothing there, right? Okay, then that's remission. But in myelodysplastic syndrome, remission means that your blood counts are normal without any help. So you're not getting EPO, you're not getting Neupogen, you're not getting transfusions, and all those blood counts are normal. So normal white count, normal hemoglobin, normal platelets, and the bone marrow is also normal. You have less than 5% blasts, you have no dysplasia, you have no chromosomal abnormalities. So everything is normal. That's what remission is. Everything is normal. Now, sometimes people go into an incomplete remission. So everything may normalize except their platelets. Their platelets may be 50,000. So that's an incomplete remission. But absolute true remission in MDS is across the board normal.
And how do you get to that?
How do you get to that? Well, you get treatments, sometimes 5-azacitidine or decitabine. And it's recommended that people get 4 to 6 cycles before they do a bone marrow to assess for their status. I mean, you can watch people's blood counts as you're going through the treatment. Most of the time when people start azacitidine, their counts are reflecting that they need treatment, right? Their white count may be low, they may be anemic, you know. And in general, and I'll show you some pictures, oftentimes blood counts get worse before they get better. And you can think about it again. If you look at the soil and the seed analogy, if you have a garden and you're tending it and you're very regular about it, that's great. And then you go away on vacation and nobody's watered your garden and no one's weeded your garden. When you come back, the weeds have really, they're very opportunistic, right? And they kind of take over. So what the azacitidine is going to do is you look at the bad cells as the weeds and you start pulling them out. So if I spend the afternoon weeding my garden, my normal plants are still there, but they're looking very scrawny, right? They have a root system, but they didn't get adequate nutrition because they were crowded out by, the sun was crowded out, the nutrients were crowded out. And so as you start to treat someone, you're removing the malignant weeds, and then the new, the remaining plants are going to have to grow, but they're going to have, they'll have some difficulty as they try to regain the normal soil as the soil changes and start developing normally. So oftentimes what we'll see is a worsening in counts the first 4 to 8 weeks, and then an improvement of counts as you get rid of the malignant cells.
Okay, but that, so what you're talking about is the chemo people have before they have the...
No, I'm talking about Vidaza, even Vidaza, same thing. Because Vidaza is, it's a smarter form of chemotherapy. It's still categorized as chemotherapy.
But you could stay on it.
You can stay on it. I have patients on it for 5, 6, 7 years. You know, people who started off transfusion dependent, they're no longer transfusion dependent.
So why don't they just begin with that instead of other things?
Well, because it's very individualized. If somebody has 5q-, you don't start them off on azacitidine, right? You start them off on lenalidomide. If somebody has, you know, mild anemia but no real need for anything else, starting off with Epogen is what you should do. You know, because it's not... one size fits all. It's here's all the characteristics. You know, what's your subtype? What's your IPSS risk group? You know, what kind of low blood counts are you experiencing? Maybe none. You know, for many people who get diagnosed with a really low risk MDS, the doctor says, come back in a month or come back in 3 months, and then we'll see you. And you kind of walk out the door a little stunned, but you know, perhaps that's what needs to be done. There's nothing to, you know, where do you begin treatment? And that's some of the questions when you look at, you know, the studies that are going to be done here with low-risk patients, when do you really institute therapy? And currently in 2015, what we're saying is if people have symptoms, like you're symptomatic from the anemia, maybe you have heart palpitations, headaches, shortness of breath, fatigue that interferes with your being able to do what you want to do, then the provider will say, okay, it's time to start therapy. And this is because of all these other factors, here's what we'll start with.
Because I know I went like a year, I went more than a year, almost 2 years. And we watched.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Right.
And then it started slipping a little lower, and then she said,
time to start. Right?
How often should you have a bone marrow test?
It all depends. If you're a low risk, if you're a high risk, if your blood counts are stable, if your blood counts are dropping. So it really depends on what's going on. You know, certainly you need one at diagnosis, right? And then if you're starting on a therapy, say you're starting on azacitidine, many physicians will say, in the community, that you don't need to have a bone marrow in like 4 to 6 months if your blood counts are beginning to improve, okay? If your blood counts in 6 months are identical from when you started the azacitidine therapy, most providers would say, let's do one and kind of see where you're at. Are you the same? Are you better? Or are you worse? So it's...
What's the difference between Procrit and Aranesp?
Aranesp?
Yes.
So one is the method of delivery. One of them is a fat-soluble molecule, and so it has longer efficacy. So the Aranesp can be given. The Aranesp and the erythropoietin are the same. Darbepoietin is another medication, and that one is a fat-soluble. So Aranesp is Epogen, erythropoietin. That's the brand name versus the generic name.
Okay, so Procrit and our... similar.
They're the same. They're bioequivalents the same. Okay. With a different label. And there's also a medicine called Darbepoietin, which is a long-acting. You can get that injection every 3 months. But many insurances who are paying for those injections will say they pay for Epogen or Darbepoietin, but they don't pay for the long-acting. So sometimes they're the gatekeeper.
Yeah, I know my Arab, they said they can raise that drug.
They can raise the dose.
Raise the dose.
Yep. Yeah, up to 80,000 units.
Huh?
Up to 80,000 units.
I'm getting 200 now.
You're on the longer acting one. So it's kind of, it's like metric and English system. There's meters and inches. Mm-hmm. So they're, you have to know what the...
Yeah.
How do you equilibrate them, right, and make them say the same
but
thing?
But he said it could go up. He could raise it if I needed to.
Yeah, you can. And that what we also know about any of the red blood cells, so those that's a red blood cell stimulating hormone, right? You can ask that's Lance right. Armstrong.
Except when he, that's what he did.
Is there any indication as to the length that you can use
Procrit?
The Procrit, like I started 6 months ago, I started a year ago at 20, 6 months ago went to 40, now, and used to do it every 2 weeks, now we're doing it every week, so we're really getting twice as much. Is that an indication it's not working, that it is not as effective as it used to be?
So erythropoietin works on a hormone in your body, okay? So on your adrenal glands, we normally secrete erythropoietin and from our bone marrow as well. And it's one of the ways that our body creates hemoglobin, but it's not the only way. And for patients who have MDS, if you begin to have very high doses of erythropoietin and you're not getting benefit from it, it's not maintaining your hemoglobin, then that's usually, it can be a sign to try something else. So you can think about it as your body only needs so much erythropoietin, right? So if I tried to pour water into my full bottle, it's just going to spill over. So it's really, it doesn't benefit, right? But if your bottle is half full, then putting some in is going to give you benefit. But there comes a point in time where adding erythropoietin is not giving you the benefit because that's not the problem any longer. Now the problem is that your bone marrow more than likely is beginning to fatigue.
So would you have your bone marrow checked at that point?
I think that's a good time to get your bone marrow checked, you know.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Anything else? All right, I'll go backwards a little bit. Let's see. So Dr. K talked about this. What is it? So the M in myelodysplastic syndrome means myeloid. So the stem cell either goes to the lymphoid family or the myeloid family. And the D is dysplastic, which means an abnormal shape. And I'm not a pathologist, although I have friends that are. But that indicates just some very unusually shaped cells. And, you know, why is that important? If you think about when we drive a car, when we're in a car, you know, we're assuming that the wheels are round, right? If you have a flat spot on your wheel still works, but it really doesn't work as well, right? And is it going to impact on the way your car functions? Mm-hmm, it will. And it's the same thing with the cells. The abnormality in the shape disallows them from doing their job properly. So the job of the red cell is to carry oxygen to our bodies, right? We live on oxygen. That's just the name of the game. And it can't do that very effectively when it doesn't carry the right shape. And hematopoiesis is a big word that just means the development of blood cells. And just like, you know, my garden that I didn't tend in the summer, when you begin to allow, when the bad cells begin to crowd out all the good cells, you start having cytopenias because the weeds in my garden are just like the weeds in my bone marrow in that they begin to suppress the normal cells. And that's when you start seeing changes in blood counts. So you have cytopenias or low blood counts. And then again, what's the risk of this? Some people can develop leukemia. As the disease progresses, what can happen is that the bone marrow function can decline. So if you're getting Aranesp and you're getting a little bit more and you've been doing it for a bit and it doesn't seem to be working as well, it's time to take a look and see what's going on inside. Because the blood counts, unfortunately, when we draw them from the vein, there's not a one-to-one correlation of what's going on inside the bone marrow, which is why you have to do the exam. All right, So there's the lymphoid cells, and then there's the myeloid cells. And what should be out in our blood, all the normal cells that are created from the myeloid stem cell are neutrophils, right? People talk about a white blood cell count. There are five major types of white blood cells, and the neutrophils should be about 80% of it. they fight bacterial infections. Okay? So when you look at your blood count, it'll say your CBC stands for complete blood count, and the three major pieces that have meaning, the WBC, white blood cell count, and within that, the ANC, the absolute neutrophil count. How many of your white blood cells are neutrophils? So it should be 80%. Sometimes in MDS, the absolute neutrophil count is really, it drops, and you have more lymphocytes than neutrophils. And then these are some other cells, basophils and eosinophils, macrophages. Platelets are the other thing you want to look at, right? And then red cells or hemoglobin is what we look at in the CBC. So white blood cell count with the paying attention to the absolute neutrophil count, platelets, and then your hemoglobin. So in MDS, we have, you know, defects then in that marrow environment, and then we have abnormal blood development. So what happens when that happens? So the normal ones kind of like go to the side, and there are all these factors that really are being studied, but then we have these immature cells. So immature cells, as a stem cell grows up, by the time it goes from stem cell to mature cell, there's a process, and the baby cells are called blast cells. Those are immature cells. It's normal to have them because it's part of normal maturity, right? But all good little babies need to go to college and grow up, right, and get a job. So, and that's what our blood cells should do. They should grow up and be functioning members out in our blood doing their job. But they get arrested, they get stopped. They stop growing, and they are blast cells. And so the interesting thing about malignant cells is that they become immortalized. So they don't die. Normal cells are very interesting. They live their useful life, and then they die, and our body replaces them. And there's basically this one-to-one replacement. So that's why we all don't, like, bleed to death by the time we're one, right? Because our cells just replace. And as we grow bigger, then they just replace. But these immature cells continue to multiply without dying. There's no natural cell death. And so when we see the accumulation of them in the bone marrow, it's because they're immortalized. And when you think about how that happens, when the cell replicates or duplicates, usually one cell will just replace itself. Well, with malignancies, one cell becomes two cells, and then two cells become four cells, and four cells become 16, become 32. So they double. So we talk about a doubling time. And if you take just one cell and you double it 30 times, how many cells do you think that makes? Over a million. So in 30 doublings, you have a million cells from one cell that should have died and just replaced itself. So we start seeing the accumulation of the blast cells in the bone marrow crowding out the other cells. And there's nothing to, you know, they're not naturally programmed to die, so they start accumulating and crowding out the other cells. So those are those immature cells. And that's when we start seeing then our normal cells are being crowded, and our cells are, when we do the bone marrow, you might read in the report that it says something called hypercellular. So we all have cellularity in our bone marrow, and it's a simple equation. You take 100% and you minus your age, and that should be your cellularity, okay? So it changes with time. And if you have more than expected, we say it's hypercellular. Like hyperactive children are pretty active. Hyperactive bone marrows are very active. And there's usually two reasons for bone marrows to be active. One of them is you may be getting ready for a stem cell transplant or have had like an accident, you know, like you lost a lot of blood and your body's got to get busy and replace them, or you have an infection and your body's busy. But the other is disease because of that, because of doubling. It's hypercellular. And it's a mix of how much available tissue is there to fat, really. And that's just the bottom line. And so you have a lot of tissue that's very active if you're hypercellular. So you have a lot of cells in there. But you have blood counts that are very low, which kind of seems a little odd, but that's what happens. All right, so how is MDS diagnosed? Well, some of you in this room talked about that you needed surgery, right? Because no good cardiologist is going to touch a patient or his lawyer unless he checks your CBC, right? So you get a CBC. And, you know, through the decades, more and more primary care doctors are beginning to recognize symptoms of anemia as tiredness. You know, there are some providers that say, oh, you know, you're a 60-year-old woman, you're postmenopausal, of course you're tired, you know, whatever. So they kind of, they disregard it. But so it can get picked up by a primary care doctor who does a CBC and pays attention. You know, why are you anemic? It's not normal to be anemic. That's really not normal physiology. There's many types of anemia. There's iron deficiency. People in this room are not iron deficient. I doubt. If anything, when you get a transfusion, you get all this iron. You can have some vitamin deficiencies. So some of those fixable anemias that Dr. K talked about, that's why. Some people get diagnosed with MDS because they're symptomatic, they're anemic, and then they go see medical attention. Some people are very ill by the time they get diagnosed, and you know they may have very, very aggressive disease that is presenting itself like leukemia because it's easy to disregard symptoms, right? You're short of breath, you're tired, you know. Other people can get diagnosed because of their low white cells, they get infections. So perhaps they have an ear infection, then they get a pneumonia, then they get another pneumonia, and then they have, you know, then they have some other infection, like a gallbladder infection, you know. And that really, if you think about it, it's not normal, right? Yeah, people get pneumonia. Yeah, people get, you know, an ear infection, whatever. But to have repetitive infections is usually going to trigger to the primary care doctor, we better draw a CBC and see, right? So their white cells could be very low and they're neutropenic, and that's how they get diagnosed. So lots of different ways. But eventually you all meet your friends, the hematologist, right? And usually it says hematology oncology, right? And people are convinced they've been sent to the wrong doctor, right? Because it's, you know, to get the phone call of, you need to come back. We found these abnormalities in your blood counts. I mean, that's a phone call where you just, it doesn't compute, right? It's kind of like watching a reel on TV, but you can't hear it. And so that's what happens. And then, so we talked about the bone marrow and all those things that need to be done. And then, you know, some other things that get done is that we do definitely test people's thyroid function. We do lose that a bit as we age, you know. Testosterone drops as men age. And then we have to just look at organ profiles as well. But all that taken together then helps us get the diagnosis of MDS. And, you know, like I said before, you should really own a copy of your pathology and know your subtype, and then know your score. And you can do your own score on the website. And so this is a busy slide, but it basically says that there's a lot of different ways to classify myelodysplastic syndrome. So 1960, 60 cases. Then in the early 70s, the first classification system came about. And one of the gentlemen who, the physicians that was really responsible for the MDS Foundation to get organized, John Bennett, was on the group. FAB stands for French, American, and British. So even back in the 60s and 70s, they recognized as a professional group that they were all seeing the same thing, but what were they seeing? And how can we put consistency and standardization to this nomenclature so that we can begin to understand it? So that's what FAB is. So the French, American, and British hematologists got together and said, let's get some substance to it. So they talked about five major subtypes. Four of the five revolve around anemia. 85% of all MDS patients have issues with anemia because the red cell is so involved. So there's refractory anemia, and then the ring sideroblasts. We talked a little bit about that. And then excess blasts. How many blasts are too many to have? Over five. That's too many. And they categorize them into RAEB1 or 2. That just stands for refractory anemia with excess blasts. And then in the late 90s, the WHO, the World Health Organization, began to look at that information with new scientific information and start adding in cytogenetics and, you know, recognizing some of these MDSs behave differently than others. Some of them, people can have really high white counts where their white count is 200,000, so it behaves differently than someone has a low count. Anyway, so And then they just talk about how many blasts and all these dysplasia. So there's kind of a lot that goes into it, but and it continues to evolve. So we talked about this already, right? The IPSS and the IPSSR. And it really helps your doctor understand what your risk and prognosis, and it really becomes the cornerstone of deciding what are we going to do about treatment, what treatment is appropriate for you, because everyone is different. And just because the diagnosis says myelodysplastic syndrome, there's a lot of different, that looks a lot of different ways. I mean, everybody, the folks in this room who are, you know, affected with it, everyone is different. You're not the same. We're not going to do the same thing for Pat as we do for Mary J, as we do for Don. We're just not going to do that. We have to look into all these other factors. This is the website. If you wanted to go on it, then you just go ahead and you can put it on your iPhone. I don't know if anybody's savvy with the iPhone. You can. I have to have it on my phone because I do this in clinic a couple times a day. we talked about what do we know about MDS. We know that the largest group of folks that get affected are as we age, so in the 70s. It is a malignancy and is the only potential. See that word, how it's qualified? Potential cure. It's, right? But the leading cause of, you know, what do people fail from? People fail from the disease itself, about 80%. Or complications of the MDS on some prior existing illnesses. So people who have pre-existing heart disease, like they've had a bypass or they've had a major heart attack, they have damage to their heart already, those people don't necessarily tolerate having a lower hemoglobin threshold than someone who hasn't had that, because they have less tissue in their heart that's really available to them. So that they can have more problems. And what do we know? That risk stratified treatments, that basically says, let's look at all of your characteristics and pick the best treatment for you. That's what a risk stratified treatment is. And things are individual. When do we start treatment? When do we start it? We start it when people basically have indications that they need treatment. So what's going on with your transfusions? Do you get one transfusion a month? Do you get one transfusion a week? Do you get one transfusion twice a week? I have a gal on, she's been on treatment. She has a lot of illnesses that coincide to her MDS. She's in her late 60s. She does get treated. Her platelets, she lives with a platelet count that's under 10,000, and she has for 2 years. She's had no major bleeding episodes, so that's part of that accommodation, people living with a new normal. But she's a very poor transplant candidate, so she continues on treatment with azacitidine. I think she's had 28 treatments. And we started treatment with her when her anemia really started to impact her quality of life. She has very bad emphysema. She smoked like 4 packs of cigarettes a day for 40 years. No, she doesn't smoke anymore. She doesn't smoke anymore. But some things can't be reversed, right? When you do damage to your lungs, then, you know, you do damage. And so, but that's who she is. And, you know, she watches grandchildren. She drives a car. She comes to clinic. But she gets transfused. She gets transfused still every week. She gets 1 or 2 units of blood. And she's okay with that, you know. And we continue to do the therapy. Doesn't cure her disease, but it does keep her disease stable. And she has a good quality of life. She doesn't live in the hospital. She's like never hospitalized. So, and then when we look at, you know, so all those things need to be considered. Now, something we didn't really talk about was something called secondary MDS. See how it says primary versus secondary MDS? So secondary MDS sometimes is called therapy-related MDS. So people survive malignancies. Men survive prostate cancer. Women survive breast cancer. People survive lymphoma, multiple myeloma. But to survive those treatments, they're often given pretty high doses of chemotherapy and or radiation. And it can damage the DNA further to 3 to 5 to 7 years later. They may develop MDS even though they're cured of their breast cancer. And so we call that a secondary or a therapy related. Now, those people, are just like you, but they don't get scored in the IPSS scoring system because they're therapy related. Our largest group of cancer survivors actually is Hodgkin's disease. So Hodgkin's lymphoma is usually a disease of younger people. I saw three people on Friday, 26, 28, and 29, all three women, all going through Hodgkin's therapy. Cancer, you know, they get chemotherapy every other week for 16 weeks. So that has changed over time, some of the drugs, but we're seeing more and more Hodgkin's people survive 25, 30 years later. They've developed MDS in their 50s. So, and we treat them, we go through the same series of individualized treatments. How old are you? Are you a potential transplant candidate? How should we treat you? What else is going on? So that's a whole nother layer of people who have MDS are these cancer survivors, and they call them therapy related. And then we make, you know, treatment selection is, you know, what really is going on, and you know what are all, I call it the disease signature when you think about what is your disease, all those things are based in it. All right, so we talked somewhat of this. What kind of things are available? So all hail the potential cure for transplant. Okay, we'll kind of put that to the side. But then there are what we consider in America supportive care. In Europe, they call it active therapy. So if you get blood transfusions and you get shots of EPO or Neupogen, if you live in Europe, they say you're undergoing active treatment. And I do agree with them because it's doing something rather than doing nothing, right? And then there's a number of medications. Lenalidomide or Revlimid is a pill that's taken. Vidaza is the trade name. Azacitidine, 5-azacitidine is the compound name. And that came out in 2004. It's an injection, and it can be given as injections like insulin, or it can be administered intravenously. For some patients who already get transfusions and they have a portacath, getting the infusion, people would rather get the infusion than get the shots because it's at least 2 shots a day for 5 to 7 days every month. It all depends. Some people they're like, I just want to get in and get out. And when you look at how much time you spend in clinic, chemotherapy is expensive, right? So first of all, the pharmacist does not make up your drug until you're there and you've been cleared, okay? So it's not like, why can't this go faster? Well, that's just not how it's done. So you get there, you check in, you do all the stuff. But that can be an injection, which is quick, right? You get in the chair, they do the triple check, you show them your belly or your arm, and they give you a couple shots and you're out the door. Infusions take longer, right? If you don't have a port, you have to start an IV, you know, you sit there longer, it's like a 20-minute infusion. Dacogen or decitabine is another drug. It's similar to azacitidine, but it's a few molecules different. That's only infusion. And then there's some chemos out there, and then again the clinical trials. So,
did they ever expect maybe the 5-Aza to be in pill form?
It's right now in clinical trials. We have a clinical trial open with oral azacitidine, and it's working just fine. People are doing
well.
How long
do you think that might be?
I think they'll finish. So they have to get enough people in the study, and then they have to analyze the data, and then it goes to the FDA. Probably a couple years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you know, people want pills instead of shots. But it's interesting that you know when people take pills, sometimes they don't take the pill.
Yeah.
There's some other leukemias that require you to take a pill a day, and people don't take it. And they're usually horrifically expensive. Like, I think Revlimid is the true cost of the medication. Now, sometimes, you know, it all depends. Like, when you look at your insurance, I would encourage all of you to really take a look at your insurance and get a supplement, like a Part D supplement, to make sure that your prescription drugs can be covered. Because all you have to do is get one expensive drug and, you know, your hair will fall out. It's there. So I think Revlimid is $3,500 a month if you don't have any assistance. So it all depends on what your insurance company is paying. And the other option when people have, like, who can afford that? Nobody. So most companies have what's called patient assistance programs, where they provide drug at a greatly reduced cost, like maybe $30 to patients. All of the big pharmaceutical companies have that because otherwise they couldn't do business. You know? So they're out there. All right, so what else is out there? So there's some other drugs out there in clinical trials. The one drug that he was talking about this morning that they talked about at the big meeting, the rigosertin, the results of that were okay, and they're bringing it forward into more clinical trials before the FDA says, okay, we'll approve it in this indication. So when the FDA gives a drug company an indication, they basically say, you can use drug X if the person has disease X1, okay? So I can use lenalidomide if I have 5q-, but if I don't, then they're going to say, no, you can't use that. And then your insurance company will say, well, and we're definitely not going to pay for it if you're using it without the indication. So anyway, so this is an older list. And when you look at what are they targeting, we talked about like the soil or the seed. That's exactly what this list represents. Histone deacetylase inhibitors, the HDAC, the panobinostat one at the bottom, that targets the DNA. It helps change the characteristics of the DNA. The PI3-1 kinase, that's a soil changer. So, I mean, there is a lot going on. Nothing's been shown to be, like, the winner, right? No magic bullet yet, but they're working on it. So there is a lot of research. And if you like to go on the internet, I think probably, you know, looking at the MDS website, because that'll link you to the National Cancer Institute, what's a valid trial, that's where you want to look. All right. So other things that we think about, a big key point is that all active treatments for MDS require time to work. If you're on azacitidine or decitabine, you have to allow for 4 to 6 weeks. If you're on Epogen, actually, it's recommended to be on for at least 12 weeks before you say this dose isn't working or we need to do something else. And the other thing for Epogen is that red cells require certain nutrients. They require folic acid. So make sure you're taking a vitamin that has high levels of folic acid in it, or folate, as well as B6 and B12. So those are other building blocks of the red blood cells. And then we talked a little bit about blood counts getting worse before they get better. And then, you know, talking to your provider. If you start on a treatment and you start having side effects, you need to pick up the telephone and call your doctor, okay? So if you say, I'm having mouth sores, or I can't swallow, or I have this funny-looking rash, you really need to call your doctor. I would say, especially as we look at November, you know, two things that everybody in this room should think about is to make sure that you've gotten your flu shot and the people that you live with got their flu shot, because infection still it can be difficult for people. And then good hand washing. So make sure you're washing your hands. You know, pack some Purell and do good hand washing, because to protect yourself from infection, the best thing to do is just wash your hands. Soap and water's fine. You know, if you're someplace, if you go to the store, wipe off the bar. Yeah, and go ahead and do that. All right, so this is just that, like, picture of why does it take so long? So this is, you know, what's happening inside the bone marrow. So this is supposed to give you an insider's look of what's going on in the bone marrow. As the blood counts drop, as the MDS progresses, because they're crowded out by the abnormal cells, okay? And so we're going to watch somebody's neutrophils. So the graph in the right-hand side, so absolute neutrophil count, this person already is kind of neutropenic. And what do you see? The line goes down, right? And then it begins to slowly go up to a better level. So that first bar tells us that, you know, there are a lot of abnormal cells. So the big purpley cells with the lobules inside, those are blast cells. So you want to get rid of those. And the red discs, those are hemoglobin cells. So as you start cleaning out the bone marrow, you see a drop in the blood counts. And that's expected. But as it begins to recover, then normal cells, and then you should start seeing a rise. So you can see a difference in the pictures, right? Mm-hmm. There are not as many cells as the one to the left, but they're starting to look a little bit better until you get normal cells back. So everything on the right-hand side really looks relatively normal. And then you see the blood counts return. And, you know, during this time period, that's taking a good, you know, this is the actual person. So this is weeks. So up to 6 weeks, the person's counts are going down, down, down. It's really not till about week 11 or 3 months later, right, that this person's blood counts are leveling out. And that's the time when people start saying, okay, we can, you know, you just, people's blood counts tell you, you don't have to come in as often, you don't need transfusions, you don't need Urinesp. But it's that low point that people are, they don't feel great. You know, when your blood counts are low, most people don't feel well. They feel cranky. So let's see. Time, again, we talked about this before. And there are strategies getting through those initial cycles of chemo. So at our center, when someone starts treatment, we see them, right? We recommend starting treatment. We're going to see you in a week, and we're going to recheck your blood count. So that first month, we will see you every week just to check your blood count, just to see how you're doing, making sure that everything is okay. You know, there are certain people, because of risk factors, do get put on some prophylactic antibiotics. Like, when do you take antibiotics if your blood count is low? The studies have shown us that, in general, it's not a good idea to put everybody on prophylactic antibiotics. You know, that would be like taking an Augmentin or a Cipro every day, because then what we add to is the generation of superbugs that no longer are effective to antibiotics. So there is a place for it, but again, it's individualized. So we would see you, and if you do well during the first 4 weeks, then the next time around, we may not see you the second week, we may see you the week after, you know? And I would say, too, if you are on treatment, you know, learn how to contact your doctor or your nurse practitioner, get their card, get their email. I'm an email person. I never am at my desk. So if you want something, email me. I'll answer you sometime during the day or after the day. If it's urgent, page them. If you ever have a fever, 100.5 or greater, you need to call. You know, you're going to need to be seen or admitted or something, you know. But don't wait.
I was also told that my dentist said, yeah, I need to know from your doctor about whether or not you need to be on antibiotics prior to getting your teeth cleaned.
Yeah. So the rule of thumb and the recommendation from the American Dental Association is if you have an implanted port, you should be on prophylactic amoxicillin. You take 2 grams the night before and 2 grams the morning of if they're going to do a cleaning. If you're going for a regular exam, you're okay. And for my patients who are neutropenic, I don't require them to go on antibiotics if they're going for a cleaning. They need to inform the dentist that, like, my platelets are low, so I might bleed more. So just let them know what's going on health-wise. Some dentists get a little shy. They're like, yeah, I'll call your doctor, you know. And then if you look at extractions, you know, then you have to do other magical things, like give people platelets if they're truly going to get an extraction. Because that's another way people get diagnosed with MDS is they get a tooth pulled and they never stop bleeding. So that's just another thing. All right. This is just an example of a patient who was on azacitidine. He happened to be an engineer, so he plotted his own numbers. And so he started, so the purple squares are his hemoglobin, the yellow triangles are his platelets, and the white blood cells are the darker ones. And so you go time from left to right. So you can see that, you know, initially his anemia, so if you look at what's normal, okay, so way back here in 2010, he had a relatively normal hemoglobin, and, his platelets were like 80,000, so that's not normal, and a white blood cell count, that also is not normal. So his counts are kind of dropping, and then he starts his chemotherapy, right? So you can see that he's got some variability, but in the long term, you know, he gets cycle 1, 2, 3, 4, and then he gets a transplant. And then after his transplant, his counts really take a jump up, right? Because now he's got somebody else's stem cells making all of his blood. Whereas over here, you know, First, we have to get rid of the bad cells before you can get the transplant. So that's just an example of somebody who you could see they're up and down. And they got worse before they got better, but they did improve, especially the platelet count. All right. This is somebody who's been on lenalidomide, like Sharon's been on it. She said like 8 to 10 years. This person's been on for 10 years. And you can see their hemoglobin initially started out at 9, and now they went up, and they've had some variability in their blood counts, right? So the pink is the hemoglobin, a little bit of up and down. But this person's been on it for 10 years. And so how long do people stay on it? As long as they benefit. And this person's been on it for a long time. Again, this is somebody who started off low. You know, you can see the up and down. Actually, I went backwards. All right. So what do I do to stay healthy? So sometimes people have questions about diet. What I would say to you is eat foods that are probably as close to what God created. That's a good diet, you know. Try to eat less processed and more, like, natural. Wash things that come out of the ground. You don't know who's picking the food. You don't know how clean their hands are, so make sure things are washed, right? You know, so that's what I would say. Continue to walk. You said you're a walker. You should do that. Avoid infection, we talked that. Avoid bleeding. You know, you should do things that you like to do. Some people like to ride bikes, ride horses, drive motorcycles. You know, make sure that you get enough rest, but remember to balance that rest. Sometimes when we really don't want to do anything, the best thing we could do is get on our 2 feet and get out the door, right? Clear your mind, go for a walk in your neighborhood, you know, walk down the road just to get outside and take a deep breath. You know, there's lots of resources. The MDS Foundation is a great place for reliable information. So just be careful where you go on the internet. And when you need help, ask for help. If your kids say, what can I do? You say, could you clean out the gutters? Can you flip the storm windows? You know, can you clean out the basement? What do you want for Christmas? A cleaning lady, you know? So make life practical and helpful. What do you need help with? Here's what I need help with. And then, you know, be a participant. Know, for some people like to know everything. Some people like to know not so much. So you find what you like, and, you know, your partner or your family may be the exact opposite of you, but, you know, there's enough information out there to make everybody healthy. Oops. Then this is that book that you have, and I told you it's available online. And then there's an online interactive format. We talked about that already. And then in there is, if you want to keep track of your own numbers and transfusions, there's a way to do that, both in that spiral book and the book itself. And then pages 85 to 91 and then the big book are looking at your progress and just kind of useful tools to take to your healthcare provider visits. So that's where that can be found. If you don't know how to get a hold of the MDS Foundation, all you have to do is look on the back of some of the information here today, and that'll give it to you. And then Audrey's email is down there. And then this is just kind of going through the book itself. It talks about what is MDS. So when you go home and, you know, it's always interesting to go to conversations like this, and you think you understand it, and then you walk out the door and you go, what did they say? So it's all written down. It's in the book. So, you know, how do you understand it? What about quick tips? What about iron overload that we really didn't talk about? And then tab number 5 is really looking at your MDS plan and how to find that. And then the foundation is tab number 6. And that is the end of what I have to say. So, questions? I said we'd end at 2. I'm a minute and a half late.
I have a question about hematocrit, and I'm probably mispronouncing that.
Great, hematocrit. So when you look at your CBC, there's hemoglobin and hematocrit, right? So it's always a 1-to-3 ratio. So if your hemoglobin is 9, your hematocrit's going to be 27. So some centers report hematocrit instead of hemoglobin. It's very European to report hematocrit.
I always feel really bad when mine is low.
The hematocrit? Well, because then your hemoglobin is low, too.
So they
correlate.
Okay.
It's a 1-to-3.
Okay.
So if your hematocrit is 20, if your hematocrit is 18, your hemoglobin is 6. That was the last lady I saw yesterday. So she's getting transfused today. 6.3 she was. And she was absolutely fine with that, by the way. She's I'm a little tired. So she had MDS and she had a transplant. And her hemoglobin, she has something called an ABO incompatibility, where her blood type and her donor's type are different. And so she's changing blood types. But in between time, then her blood counts are very, her red blood cells are very low. So she was, yeah. She did okay. She was like, she's like, I'm okay. So it's always a ratio. Other questions?
For the bone marrow donors, so many people still think that to have to give the bone
stem cells?
Yes. That you still have to go to the hospital and go into the back, do all that stuff. Yeah. That isn't
so
anymore.
So 99% of all stems, so now we don't call it bone marrow transplant, we call it stem cell transplant, right? Because people get their stem cells. So just like we have stem cells in our bone marrow, how does the donor, how do they give it? They get 4 days of Neupogen shots, the white blood cell shots, and that causes the bone marrow to overproduce them, and then they get out into the peripheral blood. And then they get hooked up to an apheresis machine. So it's basically an IV in each arm. The blood gets taken out. It gets centrifuged. And the machine is smart enough to know the weight of the stem cells, which it collects. And then the blood gets returned in the other arm. So it takes about 4 to 5 hours, and the stem cells are collected. So there's about, there in Europe and for aplastic anemia, sometimes they ask donors to go to the operating room to get their stem cells collected. There's no Neupogen, and then it's just like doing, like myself and the physician, we would be in the operating room, and we're doing bone marrow aspirations, about 50 on each side. So the person's out under general anesthesia.
It's kind of like giving blood. I mean, as far as if you donate blood.
Right.
I mean,
if you've ever donated platelets, it's the same process. It's the same machine.
I've never donated platelets, but I've seen it. I get blood, but I haven't done
it's the same process with a little bit of a tweak to it.
Yeah. That's a good to know for
right.
for donors, because mm-hmm. so many people, I don't want to go to the hospital, get that in my back.
That's not the way it is.
It doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some people.
Yeah, and people don't mind. The people who we've done so very few. In the past 13 years, I've gone to the OR twice to do a stem cell harvest.
Oh, really?
It's just not done anymore. So, anyway. All right. Well, I hope you had your questions answered, or at least your understanding increased. Thanks, everyone, for coming, especially. Where's your puppy?
He's right here. He's sleeping.
He's happy.
Especially Coco, right?
Coco. She's happy.